you for joining. Very excited for Young Israel to partner with the Center for Modern Torah Leadership, with Rabbi Clapper's Summer Beit Midrash, to have a community shiur with Rabbi Dov Linzer. And I remember when I was in the Summer Beit Midrash in 2005, having the same opportunity to learn with Rabbi Linzer of the day, and then having a community lecture in the evening. Linzer has so many incredible accomplishments and achievements. He's really the chief architect behind the curriculum of Yeshivat Chol Levei Torah. And personally, I'll introduce him by saying that he's been a mentor of mine from a distance and was a coach for me when I was serving at Yale. And his scholarship is first rate, and I think that's clear. But what I experienced with Rabbi Linzer that is distinct is his exquisite sensitivity, that he's able to observe human struggle, to empathize with it, and then to act very quickly based on that observation. And and in all my interactions with him in consulting some very complex matters, that was very distinctive, your ability to identify and to identify suffering, to identify with it, with the person, mm-hmm. and then to do something about it. And that's a real model for me. So I want to thank you for that, and we're excited to learn with you tonight for on the topic of inclusion, accessibility, and the mikvah, and we had a great chat leading up to this. Our community, of course, is on the verge of renovating our mikvah, and so it's something that is represents the sort of intersection of the topic of the Kollel of the summer, and also an issue that is on the front of our minds in the community.
Thank you.
Without further ado,
thank you. Thank you so much, Rabbi Shepherd. And I really appreciate the introduction. And, you know, the issue about finding ways to make sure that we identify with people, and the issue of empathy and not just sympathy, is a really important one, and something that I think I'll be touching on in a moment. I know when I spoke to Rabbi Chesis, he spoke to me about how you know, there has been a whole renovation of the mikvah, and that it's now wheelchair accessible, and that really wanted to hear a shiur relating to this issue about accessibility or inclusion in the mikvah. I want to say something, first of all, about the word inclusion. I probably should have said accessibility, because, but, you know, accessibility, I think, sometimes makes us think too much about, like, physical access, but still, inclusion itself is a certain loaded word. I have two boys who are both on the autism spectrum, and, you know, and I speak about the issue of inclusion in many different contexts. And, you know, my wife, who is very, very wise, you know, she said to me, "I hate the word inclusion." Why does she hate the word inclusion? Because inclusion means there's some people who are outside, and we're going to do this tremendous thing and bring them in and include them. And she said the word, it's not about inclusion, it's about membership. Everybody is a member, and it doesn't matter what their different, you know, circumstances are, whether, you know, they're dealing with physical disabilities, intellectual disabilities, whether they have nice personalities or not nice personalities, everybody is a member, and everybody has a right to be part of and fully participate in the religious life of the community. So that is really what I want to talk about in terms of the issue of the mikvah. We're going to soon turn specifically to discuss ways in which I sort of have seen that this is addressed in the context of the mikvah. But I want to start by making some more broad statements about this and about the sort of sense of our mandate in this regard. And so some of these sources here, I don't know if people maybe have heard me speak about certain topics of inclusion in the past. Some of these are some of my go-to sources on the first page. So I wanted to start with that, to lay that foundation. And the first source here from Bamidbar, and it's actually from the people who were Tamei and not able to bring the Korban Pesach, and I actually could have brought the other source from Benot Salafchad more recently, speaks to this point of inclusion versus membership. And here's what they say. The people come to Moshe and they say, Vayomru hanashim hahima elav, anachnu tmeim lenefesh adam, we are Tamei, we've come into contact with a dead body. Lama nigara, why should we be excluded? How can you allow us to be excluded? Do not bring the God's Korban, the participation in the Korban Pesach, which speaks so centrally to your being part of the community and sharing in that foundational narrative and experience. It is unconscionable that we should be excluded. And they don't say, please include us. They say, lama nigara. How can you exclude us? And then, of course, Moshe, it's always good when you go straight to God for an answer. But it's true by Benot Salafchad as well. The phrase of how can you think to exclude us? And I think that if we can just own that mode of thinking, I think 95% of the job will be done. Because when issues come around accessibility, it's like, oh my God, you know how much money it's going to cost to build a ramp? Like, it's going to cost $50,000 for what? For like one person who can't, you know, who has a hard time or whatever. So like, is it really worth it to spend that type of a money? You know, and the question is also, should we include? Is it worth it in terms of the cost and the effort or whatever to make an effort to include some people? And if we shifted the question to, I don't understand. How do you think you can build a mikvah or build a shul or build a school and do it in a way that's excluding people? On what moral basis do you think that you can do this and that's pushing people away and excluding them? And it completely shifts the way of thinking about this when we start with that sense of everybody is a member, and when we do or don't do certain things, we are making choices of whether we're excluding people. It's not a choice to include, it's often a unacknowledged choice that we are making, which has the effect of excluding. So that's, I think, a core point number one. The second point that I want to sort of address, which I like to look at the issue of the ger and the Torah's mitzvahs around the ger to serve as a type of a model of thinking about inclusion. I don't mean what I'm about to say in technical halachic terms, but what I mean about it is thinking about a model of where our sort of, you know, religious and moral mandates lie. And they point exactly along these issues that I've been talking about in terms of the question of empathy. The first thing to realize, by the way, about the ger is that, you know, we translate the ger sort of in rabbinic understanding, the ger is the convert. The ger is the person who started on the outside but is now one of us. And again, this question about how can we think that just because they're a little bit different and come from a different background, that we can now, you know, marginalize them. You know, one law for you and for the ger. It's even more powerful from the simple pshat of the Torah. The simple pshat of the Torah is that the ger is not the convert. Who is the ger in terms of the simple pshat of the Torah? The stranger who is living in the land. As opposed to the nachri, who's the foreigner who's just passing through, they're on vacation, the ger is the resident alien. Is the person that has taken up residence in the land, and they are among us and living among us, and even though that person is actually not one of us, they actually are not part of the Jewish nation, but they are living among us. That creates the responsibility of treating them as equal and not seeing them as other. Now, when we think about the mitzvahs relating to the ger, let's take a look at these psukim at the source number 2. We see something very interesting. It says, when somebody sojourns in your land, lives in your land, lo sonu oto, do not oppress them, actively oppress them. And then, you know, so that's, we're hopefully usually pretty good about not doing active bad. Like a citizen of the land he shall be, and you shall love him like yourself. You were gerim in the land of Egypt, you were sojourners, and I am Hashem your God. So what's the point of the Torah of reminding us that we were sojourners and we had this experience? And it seems to me clear that the point of the Torah is, I mean, obviously I'm not the first person to say this, but it's to sort of say, I mean, the Torah says it, atem yedatem es nefesh ager. We know what that feeling is like.
we experience that feeling, we can relate to what the ger might be feeling by trying to evoke our memory or our historical memory of what that was like to be a stranger in a strange land and feel that we don't belong and be told in a million ways, explicit and implicit, that we're not really seen as equal. We know that. And therefore, if we're able to identify, to call on that memory and to feel that, then we can understand how the ger is feeling and we can act appropriately. So this is nothing other than the mitzvah of empathy. It is of not only sort of feeling sympathy, nebach, you're disabled, you have this problem, I'm going, you know, I feel so sorry for you. No, it's putting ourselves in the other person's place and feeling what it would be as a human being to be in this place of what we would want and expect and be entitled and be entitled to as simply as a human being. And how can we not act that way towards the other person? Now, this issue of the empathy, you know, it's sometimes hard. It's hard enough in the case of the ger because how, you know, it's very easy in our nice, comfortable, you know, middle-class existence to not evoke a memory. I mean, it's only a historical memory anyway. It's not an actual lived experience of what it was to be, you know, a stranger in the strange land. It's a real challenge. In the case of disabilities, what I often speak about is like, you know, well, I never had any disabilities, so how can I sort of develop any sense of empathy, even if I wanted to? So, you know, we spend a lot of time at Chovei Torah, actually, devote like serious intensive weeks, like two weeks out of, over the 4-year cycle of dealing with the rabbi and people with disabilities in the community. An important message that we talk about is, you know, that the world is not divided into those who have disabilities and those that don't have disabilities. The world is divided into those who have disabilities and those who don't yet have disabilities. Because God willing, we will all live a very long life. And, you know, when we get older, our hearing isn't going to be the same. Our eyesight isn't going to be the same. Our mobility won't be the same. When we think about mikvah access, we're not just thinking about somebody who is, you know, a paraplegic. We might be thinking about somebody who is elderly and cannot actually, you know, move around for that reason, and has, you know, mobility issues. There are different reasons why, you know, in terms of all these different causes about ways in which, you know, probably sometime in our lives, we are not only in our family, but even in ourselves, you know, going to be dealing with issues that are challenging and issues of disability. So it's remembering what I would say is not a shared past, which is what the Torah tells us about the ger, but if you would, remembering or evoking a shared future. Imagining yourself, right, that might be my mother. You know, she's not doing so well. Who knows? A year from now, she's going to be in a condition where she needs assistance, you know, in terms of hearing and getting around and so on. That could be me in a few years from now. Okay? And if we can start to work our emotional imagination in that regard, this is what I think the Torah is commanding us about the mitzvah of Ahavas Ager. It's a mitzvah of empathy. And then I think it will really help us shift our fundamental orientation about this. You know, I sometimes sort of give the example, which is like, you know, sometimes I find myself in the supermarket, you know, in the line, and sometimes it always works out that I'm in the line that is going absolutely the slowest, right? And then you try to switch lines, and then, of course, the new line you've moved into is now the slowest. So anyway, I'm there in the line, and, you know, right in front of me is this, you know, elderly woman, and she's like, you know, I don't know, I'm sure you've experienced this, counting out her money, you know, slowly, and it's like, I gotta get somewhere, I'm 5 minutes late, could you hurry up, or whatever, and I have all these unpleasant thoughts, and then I remind myself, and I say, you know, in 20 years, that's going to be me. And somebody behind me is going to be, some young whippersnapper behind me is going to be sending all these vibes of frustration because I'm here trying to count out my money and buy something at the store. And you know what? It shifts the way I think about it. You know, once I realize that's going to be me, all of a sudden I think about it in a very different way. And I really think that this is what the Torah is sort of commanding in terms of somebody who could be marginalized in the community, and they're really commanding us in terms of this mitzvah of empathy. And that, I believe, is what the word v'ahavta lo kamocha means. I believe really by the ger, it's a mitzvah, the mitzvah of ahavas ager is a mitzvah of empathy. One way in which I sort of want to underscore this is based on a Rambam, which is really based on a Gemara. Let's look at the next Rambam. The Rambam says the following, ahavas ager Shabbat v'nichnas tachas kanfei hashchina, the mitzvah of loving the ger who's coming and being part of the Jewish people. Shtei mitzvot asei, two positive mitzvot. Achat mitnei shu bechlal re'im, he's just a fellow Jew, he's a neighbor. V'achas mitnei shu ger, v'torah amra v'ahavtim as a ger, love the ger. Tziva, now here's the curious line. Tziva al havas ager, kemoshe tziva al havas atzmo. God commanded loving the ger the same way God commanded that you should love God. Shenemar v'ahavtes Hashem Elokecha. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Atzmo of game, God loves the game, Shenemar v'ohev ager. So what's Rambam's point in saying that God commands us to love the ger the same way God commands us to love God? Like, God, we're also supposed to love our neighbor, v'ahavtel re'echa kamocha. Like, why is that any different? Love our neighbor, love God, love the ger. Where is this unique parallel between loving the ger and loving God? And I believe the answer to this is to be found in a Ramban. I didn't reproduce the Ramban. I'll tell you the Ramban. The Ramban asks the obvious question. He says, what type of crazy mitzvah is this? I'm obviously paraphrasing. What type of crazy mitzvah is this? V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Love your neighbor like yourself. He says, there's no way we can love somebody else, maybe family members, but how can we love somebody, you know, else as much as we love ourselves? How can the Torah really mean love your neighbor as yourself? And the Ramban says the answer to this is hidden in one letter. And that one letter is the letter Lamed. Ve'ahavta l'reacha. Love towards your neighbor. Act in a loving way towards your neighbor as you would act towards yourself or have your neighbor act towards you. The list speaks not about how do we feel about them, but how are we acting towards them. And therefore it says ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Now when you get to the ger, what does the Torah say about the ger? It says, v'ahavtem et hager. It doesn't say li. It says, v'ahavtem et hager. It also doesn't say kamocha. Because what the Torah, the Ramban doesn't say at this point, what the Torah is telling us is that by the ger, it's not just enough how we act. By the ger, we actually have to love the ger. It uses the direct preposition et hager. Don't act toward. Now, what's telling us to actually love the ger? Then it can't say kamocha. We have to be realistic. We can strive for the empathy. At the end of the day, it can't really be kamocha. But that's what it means that loving the ger is like loving God. Ve'ahavta not le'Hashem Elokecha, ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha. It's about an emotional connection. And what I believe, as I said, this emotional connection is it's not like romantic love. It's not friendship love. I believe that this ahava and this is empathy. It's identifying v'atem yedatem etz nefesh ager. So this is the Torah's mitzvos about a ger, but I think these two points, number one, not starting from the question of what's it going to cost us to be inclusive, but how can we be pushing people away and excluding people, lama nigara, and number two, that we have a responsibility to people who are in a position of being marginalized by the community, we have a responsibility to really identify, empathize, try to identify a shared past or a shared future, see ourselves in their place, and then act accordingly if we're really seeing ourselves in that person's position. One or two more points about this, and then we will turn to the mikvah in particular. The challenge about the mitzvah of sort of speaking, and this gets to this issue of inclusion that I mentioned, right, is that it's easy to slip from the empathy to the sympathy. It's easy to sort of speak about, oh, we have to really, really do people with disabilities, and that it doesn't become move into this way of, oh, you know, we're treating them as a special class, special accommodations, and so on. We once had somebody, Dr. Adrian Ash, who's a Jewish ethicist, in one of our weeks on disability, she herself was blind, and she was speaking at the yeshiva, and she said that she rejects the term special needs. Why does she reject the term special needs? She says, I don't have special needs. I have the same needs that every human being has. I have a need, you know, of to be loved, to be self-actualization, about, you know, food, clothing. I have the same needs everybody else has. I might need certain accommodations in order to allow those needs to be met, but I don't have any special needs. You know, and it's so easy so to not think that way. Right? And think, oh, well, you know, this is a nebuch, a special category, and so on, and not recognize, no, they have the same needs and rights and desires, whatever, that we all have, and how are we going to figure out to accommodate? So sometimes the problem of emphasizing too much of, oh, havas hager, is that it's othering, that it makes the category of other, rather than the shared humanity that we all have. So it's interesting that a balance to this is what Rav Saadia Gaon says in terms of the mitzvah of the ger. When it comes to the mitzvah of the ger, Rav Saadia Gaon does not say there's a mitzvah to love the ger. He completely does not mention that mitzvah. He doesn't say there's a prohibition against oppressing the ger. He only says one thing, three words. Source number four, gerei hatzedek ke'ezrach. The only mitzvah we have is treating them like just like everybody else, treating them equally. Okay, and that, of course, does not, you know, and this is, in a way, the whole issue around, you know, affirmative action, you know. Are you pro-affirmative action, though, you know, if you, you know, but then it singles out that the class is still treated as a different class, we should be seeking for equality, but if all you talk about is equality, then you're not addressing systemic problems. How do you both address systemic problems and be proactive, and at the same time, strive for that attitude of, you know, not attitude, that fundamental principle of equality, and we all really are the same and have the same needs, and are, you know, and we just have to figure out how everybody is going to get those needs met. So I think that the issues around the ger really provide for these important models of thinking in general around the issue about disabilities. One or two more comments about this general intro, and then we'll move into the mikvah case. So whenever I speak about the issue, you know, obviously the sources that I feel most comfortable with are, you know, and the discourse I feel most comfortable with is the halachic discourse, you know, and, you know, let's see in ways in which poskim address challenges around people with disabilities and so on. But the reality is that around this issue, 95% of the work has nothing to do with halacha. 95% of the work is totally communal. Are we as a community owning our responsibility and doing what we are needing, what we need to be doing in terms of attitude and in terms of accommodations to make everybody, you know, feel like the member that they are? That is, like, I don't want to lose sight of that for a moment, because the halachic point is the areas in which halacha comes up, halacha will usually be able to find solutions, and it's very small, okay? The real weight of the responsibility is at the communal level. That being said, okay, I do want to turn for a moment to look at two poskim that talk about their sense of mandate within halachic psak in terms of areas of making, of ensuring, you know, sort of equality. So one here is Rav Moshe Feinstein, and I love doing this tshuva because the question is, b'inyan minui ger l'rosh yeshiva, can a ger be a rosh yeshiva? Because some people might not know, part of the interesting sort of irony is, or that with all that the Torah says that a ger is kamocha in the midst of loving the ger, there's one area that halacha effectively was a machlokes between Bavli and Yerushalmi, but halacha has developed that a ger cannot have a position of authority. So the question is, what constitutes a position of authority? So somebody asked Rav Moshe, can a ger be a rosh yeshiva? So he says, avalamaisa yeshli da. So he discusses, like, we're going to have to discuss this and so on. Basically, what I joke, because Rav Moshe's conclusion is a Rosh Yeshiva doesn't have any authority. So, so I'm a Rosh Yeshiva, so it's good to know that. But his basic point really is, it doesn't have authority that you compel people, that you impose upon people. If somebody chooses to come to your yeshiva, they are accepting your authority upon them. It's not an authority that's placed forcefully on people. But anyway, but the more interesting is what he says about where he feels he's obligated to go. He says, "L'maisa yesh lida shamitzvah shel ve'ahavtim es ager mechayeves otanu lekarvam." That mitzvah obligates us to bring them close. Ulahakel b'chol inyanim elu, to find a way to be lenient. That mandate tells us that halachically we have to define the scope of a ger not serving in a position of authority as narrowly as possible. We have a mandate to ensure the maximal inclusiveness, and that's going to translate into how we sort of figure out this halacha. And therefore it seems that this is not a position of authority. So obviously you have to do the halachic work. You don't just say, oh, okay, we're going to include, end of story. Halacha, you need to actually, you know, legitimate the, you know, and argue the position from a halachic standpoint. But he says, at least within, now he's dealing within the technical mitzvah of Ahavas Ager, I'm obviously abstracting it, but he speaks about the halachic mandate that creates, or the mandate it creates within the halachic process. I want to see one other source about halacha in general, again, about the issue of disabilities, and then we're going to turn to, as I said, to the mikvah point. Here's a tshuva of the Matzis Binyamin that deals with the issue about, can you give an aliyah to a blind person? Okay, it's an interesting halacha question because the blind person isn't able to read. He's able to make the brachos, but not able to read. And what's really profound about this is, again, not only that he talks about the implications of inclusion versus exclusion, but also the very personal tone, because he wrote this tshuva after he himself became blind. So here's what he writes. Vania Marti, Afim Ruach Moshel Yaleh Alecha, even if the ruler rises against you, because the Beit Yosef or of Yosef Cairo seem to say a blind person cannot get an aliyah. Mekom Chal Tanach, do not abandon your position. Ki lo lama lo yiznach, it will never, nobody should be cast off forever. Notice the language, being cast away. Umiyamot Avizanoach, from the period time of Moshe Rabbeinu, HaTorah became in Zavit Munach, you can tell it rhymes, right? The Torah is placed in a corner. Anybody can come and take it, meaning the Torah is supposed to be accessible to everybody. And therefore, even one mitzvah, people say, what's the big deal? So you don't get an aliyah. I mean, come on, you're the Masis Binyamin, you're writing tshuvas, you're giving shiurim, you're a big halachic authority. He says, no, every mitzvah counts. And how can you tell me to not, to not care even just about one mitzvah? And here's the personal. Now that I've grown old, the light has dimmed in the skylights. Quoting from the pasuk from Yitzchak, my eyes are dim. What occurred to Rav Yosef Cairo that a blind person can't get an aliyah? I'll be driven out from God's inheritance, the Torah emet chaye olam, and being connected to the Torah, leviltiyeh chashev v'nispar minuyim lalot, not to be able to get an aliyah. Now, what's important to stop here is, because they forget the halachic issues for a moment, the poignancy of articulating what does exclusion feel like. And it's very easy, if we're not the ones that are being excluded, to say, yeah, what's the big deal? Okay, so you know what? So you don't get an aliyah. Like I said before, you're a big rabbi. Big deal. You need to get an aliyah. I mean, everybody's giving you all this kavod anyway. You're writing tshuvos. Who needs it? Like, who are we to judge what that experience feels like if we're not the person experiencing it? And here he is saying, I feel that for me not to get an aliyah, I would feel driven away, rejected, pushed out of the community, pushed away from Torah. And this is also an important point. A, to understand how are people really experiencing this, not think that we can project and know how somebody is experiencing this. And number two, to understand that the way in which when people are excluded, even from one thing, the message that they are hearing is that they are not welcome in this community, that they are being pushed away, that they're being pushed away from Torah, from mitzvos, from the community. I am not making this up. In the world of disabilities, there are countless cases where people feel, if you're not making space for my kids in your shul, then who needs this? And they basically, will leave, some people, completely leave Judaism, leave a life of Torah and mitzvos. They get a message that you are not wanted, and if you don't want me, then I don't want you. I will tell you, in my own case, my wife and I are big educators in the Jewish community, and we felt at certain stages that there was no place for our kids in a shul, in a school, and we didn't act on it, but that was a feeling we had. You don't want me, you don't want my kids means you don't want me, and you don't want me, so then why should I want you? And this is a reality, and people act on this. And this is the messages that we are not realizing that we are sending, even when we just passively wind up excluding people. And he goes on and says like this, "Ulchein amarti v'gamarti b'libi, chalila limi lazov es derech etzah chayim ulachos banfeh hafti zos hatuudam imekedem kidmasa." God forbid that I should abandon the Torah, the things that I love, mishpata v'data, v'gam leitignati balashlicha, even now that I've grown old, I will not abandon it. Ubay et halecha, I will go in it, avetach bidvar halacha, and I will open up, analyze the halachic issues, mirot alma asali harav kacha. Why did the rabbi, the Beit Yosef, Rav Yosef Cairo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, why did he do this to me? Why did he tell me that I can't get an aliyah? So I want to pause here for another moment, because it's a little funny. Why did he do it to you? I mean, you weren't born when he was writing his commentary. It's not personal. Don't take it personally. It's just the halacha. So it's all very nice to say, don't take it personally. I got to tell you, when you're the person that's being excluded, it's all personal. Okay? If you're telling me, it's not personal, whatever. No. Why are you, it is experienced personally, and it is felt personally, and the rejection is felt personally. So if he is telling me that I can't get, if he's paskening that I can't get an aliyah, that means that he is doing something to me. He is telling me that I am not wanted. So you really feel here, what the experience of exclusion that I think we usually live blissfully unaware of, because we do not actually engage people that are feeling this way, use our imagination to try to think about this and to understand what that is. It's not just, a small little thing, how it translates into a much bigger sense of rejection. Okay? And I want to read one more line. He says, Ot mehani al dibre ha'osrin, dehechi chlitu hadin. I'm astounded by those who would forbid. Because now normally, right, if you're come up with a psak and say, oh, I'm going to find a way, I'll paskin lakula to be lenient, I'll say that a blind person could get an aliyah. And normally a type of reaction you might get is, how could you be so lenient? I mean, it might be a bracha levatala, maybe we're not going to be yotzei having all seven aliyah. What allows you to be so lenient? And what he does is he completely reverses the discourse. And he says, what allows you to be so lenient, not on the mitzvah of Aliyah, but on your obligation towards your fellow Jew? What allowed you to come to a conclusion, lifrok o malchus shamayim, to cast off the heavenly yoke? This is the effect of paskening that somebody's excluded, that they basically experience this as like, they're being rejected. Hanashim ubifrapim mitzvahabim before semis kizo. So it reverses the discourse. What lets you pasken in a way that's going to exclude people? Now, the other thing, though, to say about this, and this is important, is, it's the old story, right, that we all take ritual obligations as more religious and serious than interpersonal. So you tell somebody, like, oh, no, I have to find a way to apostate to allow this because of my, obligation towards my fellow Jew, my interpersonal obligation. Nah, that's just you're being lenient. That's not really being serious about your religious obligations. We don't treat, sadly, sometimes, our ethical obligations, which are also religious and also mitzvot, in the same way. Reb Chaim, said this beautifully. He was super lenient, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, on any type of tiniest hint of a health issue. He would be ready to be mechal Shabbos. No, it might be pikuach nefesh. So he said, "Don't say I'm lenient on shmiras Shabbos. I'm very, very machmir on pikuach nefesh." And I think that that's obviously a type of a discourse that we are always challenged with. But the point that he is saying here is he's even saying, like, forget that. Don't talk to, even without the sense of, like, there's a human being here. How could you be so mean? Let's say we're only going to talk in ritual terms, religious ritual terms. So you're going to be really careful in ritual ways and say, oh, we can't give a blind person an aliyah. He says, what is the religious cost of that? What the religious cost is that what is that going to do to this person's shmiras mitzvos? You are casting the yoke of heaven off of this person. You are telling them that they are not wanted, they're rejected, and that's going to have an impact even in terms of what you consider to be religious, meaning, ritual shmirat mitzvot. So that we, and again, so what we have to really own, what is the price of rejection? What is the price of not doing everything we can to make it clear that everybody is a member and everybody has access? So those are, I think always important for me to lay some basic principles. I want to now start turning to the issue of mikvah. There's a great little picture here. If nobody has seen this, I love this image about the difference between equality, right? Everybody gets the same treatment. Everybody gets a box to stand on. Of course, that means that some people can't see. Equity is that you understand that what you need, different people need different accommodations, right? And then the real goal is justice, is addressing the systemic problems so you don't need accommodations to begin with. Now, we can't always, sometimes there's a reality, you need ramps, you need, you might need a lift, you might need whatever, but there is a question about the culture around it. How much is the culture, even when somebody is coming and you have some accommodations, how much is the culture like, oh, wait, we've got the accommodation, let me bring out the ramp here, figure out how we're going to work, and the message still is like, this place isn't really for you, but we're going to accommodate, as opposed to the sense of, this whole structure of this place means that you are you are welcoming and accommodating for everyone. So different people might, you know, need different accommodations, but the sense that systemically what we're dealing with is that everybody has access, as opposed to we're going to fix it for you. You know, it's a very different message. I know a case about a rabbi who in New Jersey, a great guy who had a shul where, he was tremendously in terms of making sure that everybody, you know, with all different types of issues and disabilities or whatever was welcome. And he had a ramp that was always there up to the bima, and everybody used the ramp. Everybody used the ramps. Okay, you go up on the ramp. He says, when he left after being there like 20 years, he says the new rabbi came in, was not as committed as he was, and he took the ramp away. And he said, we'll bring it out when somebody needs it. Okay, and people left the shul. They basically said, like, I am not going to be in a shul where when I need to get an aliyah, you're going to do something special to accommodate me. Okay, and again, even when we're being inclusive, we can be inclusive in a way that really is systemically sort of welcoming. Again, I use that word inclusive again. I make that mistake. But that's systemically welcoming, or a way that's just accommodating, but fundamentally they're bears. Now, it's not always easy, you know? I mean, there are existing mikvos out there, the existing shuls out there. Sometimes you have to do a sort of an ad hoc fix, and you can't do something that's sort of deep in its structure. But there's also the question of culture and not just the physical setup, right? And how much is the culture very clear that, you know, that everybody is welcome, as opposed to a culture of we're going to find, you know, okay, if you really need us to, we'll figure out a way to accommodate. Now, take a look here. Turn the next page, page number 3. And I want to give you a sense about what sort of accessibility is about. I see that Carrie Bornstein is here from Mayim Chaim, and Mayim Chaim does an amazing job in terms of access, both in terms of the physical access. We're going to get in talking about lifts, and that's not just about ramps and so on, but the culture of welcoming and everybody feeling welcomed and attended to. I copied here from selections from a guide done by Yad HaChazaka, which is about people, you know, helping people with disabilities, mikvah accessibility guidelines. And I just want to sort of highlight one or two points, more than one, a few points of this. So first is, look at the sort of first paragraph. The imperative applies to those with disabilities or ongoing health conditions. Unfortunately, a person can acquire temporary or long-lasting disability or health condition at any stage in life. So our mikvah buildings and infrastructure should be designed and equipped in ways that accommodate people with mobility, hearing, vision, and other disabilities. So 2 points already in this paragraph. Number one is that what I was sort of saying, this could happen to anybody at any stage in their lives, and as soon as we realize that, hopefully our attitudes and our perspective will change. And number two, it's not all about ramps. That, you know, it's about mobility, hearing, vision. We have to be thinking about a wide range of things. And the next paragraph is equally important. The following are guidelines for the design of fully accessible mikvah. It's most important that the user be able to access the building, a bathroom, a mikvah pool. It's not just about the there's also the bathroom issues. Get input and ongoing feedback from mikvah users with disabilities in your community and surrounding areas. Again, this gets to the empathy issue, or if you would, the empowerment issue. It is always so easy to say, oh, I'm going to be the tzaddik. I'm going to do the great thing and build these accommodations. You know, and the disabilities community has a line, which is nothing about us without us, right? That, you know, if you're making the decisions for us, then you're treating us as children, as not adults, as not empowered. And that itself is, you know, profoundly undermining and disempowering. And so the idea of, if you really want to understand what needs to get done, you need to talk to people. And you need to talk to the people themselves who have these needs and who actually know what needs to get done. So all of these are, you know, critical aspects. When you unpack them, you see the deep values that are present. I'm not going to go through all of the details, but I want to just point, for example, look at some things that wouldn't have occurred to me. Wouldn't have occurred to me. I know it would occur to you. Doors, doorways, and internal pathways. Doorway colors contrast against the wall colors, right? So you can see the doorway if you have a sight issue. No more than 5 pounds of pressure is needed to open doors. Doors can be opened with lever handles or with a push bar as opposed to like the twist knob. A lot of things you won't think about in terms of accessibility that, you know, that you have to be aware of. And you're aware by talking to people who have expertise and talking to the people themselves who are, you know, who have these, you know, who have these various challenges. The accessible mikvah pool, which is what we're going to get to, the hydraulic lift is available, washable, tactile, and color-contrasting warning strips, right? A gray bar perpendicular to the pool wall that rises above the water surface. And the last point is mikvah attendance, because it's not all about physical accommodations. It's also about the culture that is created, the way in which people are welcomed, engaged, and empowered. I mentioned before, you know, about Mayim Chaim. They have a lovely, like, two-minute video about it. And a key part about it is, you see, it's about this issue of like, respect and empowerment. Tell me what you need. Tell me what I can do to make this avail. You know, to make this work for you. Don't presume that you know, because you see this disability, what this person needs. And they make this point quite explicit. The mikvah experience is enhanced when mikvah users feel comfortable talking to the extended, especially about personal matters. When the mikvah user has a disability or health condition, she very much requires the ability to comfortably talk, okay? Speak to everyone in an adult tone and manner. You would not believe, or maybe you would, how as soon as somebody has a disability, particularly if they're like in a wheelchair, all of a sudden people shift to baby talk. Like, you know, like talking to them like they're in third grade. Oh, let me understand. Oh, really? You know, whatever. This so certain tone, or like as if they are somehow not intelligent and not adults. Speak to directly to the mikvah user, not to anyone accompanying her. Also, people are being helped out by an assistant, somebody with disability, pushing the wheelchair, other types of an assistant. You would not believe how much people will immediately talk to the assistant, because it's easier to relate to somebody without the disability. That's the person that needs taken care of. You're the person I can talk to. And, you know, these are the types of sensibilities that is sort of so critical. If a person is deaf or hearing, ask how she would like to communicate during her preparation. Find out from the person. Again, don't presume, okay? And which is the last bullet. Discuss with the mikvah user how she would like to prepare and immerse and how you can help. Please do not assume you know best. So all of these things logically flow from just putting ourselves in that other person's place. But, you know, it's like common sense, I say, is not so common. You know, sometimes in these areas, the sort of common sort of decency that is required, you know, to treat people as the empowered adults that they are, is so often undercut by ways we're not even aware sometimes that we are acting. What I want to do now, I'll mention, I'm not going to read it because I want to be sensitive to the time, but here are two sources, news articles I got, both very recent, from mikvaot that are doing things about disabilities. One from the New Jersey Jewish News, which spoke about, you know, some people said, nah, we can't, it was too expensive, we thought about it, not so many people were using it, or would have needed it. And another one that said, which was a couple, a Chabad couple that was involved in, what was it called? The thing that they do, a friendship circle, which is, you know, kids with disabilities or whatever. And they said, it was never a thought that we wouldn't do it. Of course. You know, we care, you know, that's, we see people with disabilities as part of a community. How could we not create a mikvah that was accessible? And that really goes to, you know, where are your priorities? Who do you see are your members? And do you see that this is something that you have to figure out? Is it worth it to include? Or how could we think of excluding? Lama nigara, right, is so central to the question of an orientation. The bottom one has to do with a case in Israel. What you also see there is that it's good in Israel with the, you know, the government supporting religious institutions that you can actually, like, get government agencies involved in creating issues of you know, about accessibility. Okay. Let's turn now to some sources about mikvah. So this has been some of the broad issues. By the way, look at this box here at the top. Okay, number of mikvahs in the U.S., 390. Mikvahs with wheelchair access and lift mechanism. I actually went around the yeshiva the other day and I asked people that question. I said, there are 390 mikvahs in the United States. How many do you think have actual, not only wheelchair access, but like lift mechanism, some way of helping somebody with a, you know, mobility issue immerse in the mikvah? And I would say that people pretty much said 5, 10, one person said 20. So I don't know if that's, it's a very sad commentary, but that people are aware about how pathetic the situation is. Okay, 20 out of 390 means 1 out of 20 mikvaot is accessible for somebody who needs that, you know, who has a need for not only the ramp, but actually getting in the mikvah itself. So imagine you're that person. Right? Imagine that there is, you know, how many hundreds of miles might you have to travel? There are 41 states in the U.S. where there is not one accessible mikvah. What if you're living in that state? So, I mean, it is really that this is where we are, you know, is, you know, it's a, like, I mean, where are those women going? What's happening to them, right? Are they are they traveling hundreds of miles? Are they not going to the mikvah? But, like, we don't ask ourselves those questions. You know, we just sort of live in our bubble. So what I want to do in the last few minutes is to talk about cases in which I see in halacha two issues. A, where halacha around issues of the mikvah we see a discussion of accommodating. I'll deal with some cases which are sort of less the types of issues I'm dealing with, the disabilities issues, but I still think relevant. And then to turn to some sources that specifically address the halachic questions around a lift mechanism, and I'll describe the lift mechanism in a minute. I apologize that they did not get a chance to translate these sources. But you know what I'm going to do? Maybe what I'll do is the following, because they're not translated and because the time is short and I want to leave an opportunity for discussion, I'm just going to summarize most of these. Okay, we'll see if I read any of them inside. But let me tell you what some of the sources I have here under the issue of accommodation are about. Number one, when mikvah on Friday night, is the water cold or hot? So if anybody here has gone to the mikvah on Friday night, the water is hot. Don't try going into a mikvah with cold, freezing water. Maybe it's warm, okay, but it's not cold. So there is a long discussion in the poskim of, oh my God, how can we allow this? You're not allowed to immerse yourself in hot water on Shabbos. Well, maybe if it's only lukewarm, it's not hot. How warm? Bottom line is that the poskim try to figure out how can we allow this, given the halachas about immersing in warm water. And bottom line, they basically don't have a good answer. But you know what they do? They say like, but that's the reality. We want women to go to the mikvah on Friday night. The water certainly can't be cold. Got to be warm, maybe even hot. I don't know if your mikvah, what degree of temperature it is. But believe me, according to, it probably is something that would, in other circumstances, be seen as a real problem halachically. But we somehow manage to, like, live with it because it's a reality. You know, if you want people to go, you have to accommodate. Another case, which is maybe more straightforward, which is a tshuva about, we want women to go to the mikvah Saturday night. And the only way that the water is going to be, and Shabbos gets out very late, and the only way that the water is going to be hot is if we get the non-Jew to turn on the water, the heater on Shabbos. Are we allowed to do it? And the answer is yes. You know, it's a sorech mitzvah and allows the woman not to wait an extra night before going home to her husband. And these are ways in which it's like, we're going to make this possible. Here are cases of halachic, as you would, accommodations. A third example is, you're not supposed to go to the mikvah during the daytime. But what happens if it is hard to go to the mikvah at night because the roads are dangerous, because other types of things? So there, when there are problems, you go to the mikvah. It's day 8, definitely, but sometimes, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, many, many, many times, even on day 7 if you can't go at night. Okay, so these are ways in which halacha understands it's not like, no, these are the standards, you've got to figure out a way to accommodate, you know, sort of your practice to these standards. It's like, if we want people to go, and we are aware of their circumstances, and, you know, sort of, you know, in terms of the realities of what the challenges that they're facing, then we're going to find a way to make it possible. So those aren't exactly parallel, but, you know, I thought that they at least show us a way in which halacha is figuring out how to smooth the path so that people can come to the mikvah rather than have something that serves as an obstacle. Now, I want to talk about the issue specifically around the lift and the interesting halachic challenges it raises, and this is not a new question. So if a woman is not able to stand on her own legs and to move and the mobility, how do we expect her to immerse in the mikvah? So this question is not a new one. How would you think before the age of lifts somebody might actually do this? Like if somebody had to go into the mikvah and they could not actually, you know, walk in, stand on their own legs and so on. Somebody carries them. Somebody holds on to them. And right. Now, it's all very nice to say, you know, I had, you know, talking about like, you know, putting ourselves in other people's place. Like my aunt a while back was, had a broken hip or whatever. When you get a broken hip at that age, it's a real issue, like months and months. Anyway, she was in a wheelchair and we got to a place where there was no, I was wheeling her around and there was like no ramp or whatever. And she just had to go like 2 feet to get to the door. And she was like a very light woman. And I said, it's no problem. I'll like just carry you. Right? And it was like, no, she was like terrified. Like there was absolutely impossible to do. I mean, somebody, so we, again, we can think from our position like, oh, big deal. I'll just carry you, you know, but it's not always so pashut. But anyway, that is what was suggested. Let's just hold the person and immerse them. And this issue, so that's the first answer. So take a look here at source number 10. Okay, this is from an early Achron, and he says the following. Maribuni says, Shuv Maaseh Ba'oso Ido, this woman's name, Adele, I guess. Sheratz, and she was not able to walk on her own legs. Sheratz to litbo leba'ala, she wanted to immerse herself in the mikvah. Velo yacholti limsolo derech ele besadin. The only thing I could figure out was have her lay on a sheet, and we will like lower the sheet down, and we'll support the sheet and hold on our hands to the corners of the sheet. Why not hold on to her directly? He says, "Aval limsolo derech la'ochza shtei nashim b'sroteihen." Let two women just hold on to her with their, you know, arms. Bekoach shelo tipol la'aretz lo. That can't work. Why not? Kevan de'ein la la'amoda raglei klal. Since she can't stand at all, tzarich achiza b'chozek. They would have to hold on very, very tightly to support her. Vika lemeches gil machayit. And if you're holding very tightly, so then the water can't get onto that body part of the woman that is being held onto very tightly. So he says, have her on a sheet and lower the sheet in. The problem with the sheet answer is that there's another halacha. And the other halacha is, you're not about to do tvila al gabe kelim. You can't immerse on top of a, like standing on a bucket, let's say, or sitting on a chair. You know, you can't immerse when you are standing and supported by a kli, by some type of halachically it's considered like an instrument is not exactly the right word. I'll say vessel, but people always think I'm talking about like pots and pans when I say vessel. Anyway, but something that is halachically like, a vessel, anyway, is some, you cannot do tefillah on it, and there are different reasons, because Chazal were concerned that people would confuse the mikveh with a bathhouse, and in the bathhouses they would sit on benches or sit on chairs, and so on. So the Maaseh Binyamin, who I mentioned before, he doesn't like the sheet answer for this reason. It's something that becoming pure, which is the halachic definition of a vessel, and therefore it is not going to work. Therefore, you can't do tefillah on top of that. It doesn't even work b'di'evid. So he says, goes back to the holding on to the, you know, hold on to her. But he says the way you deal with it is you don't hold on too tightly, you get your hands wet. Of course, you can imagine, not holding on too tightly has other problems. So how are we going to solve this issue? So basically, Poskim came up, and this goes back hundreds of years. This is not a new issue. So Poskim came up with a few types of answers. One answer is the hold on, but get your hand wet beforehand, and there, I don't want to get into the details, but if your hand is wet, and maybe if you're not holding on super tight, the wetness of your hand connects to the waters of the mikvah, so it's like, you know, if my hand is wet, and I'm holding on to somebody else, then this water is touching the person's body, and therefore it's connecting to the mikvah waters, so it's like the mikvah waters is touching the person's body. So that was one answer, or you do it loosely. The other answer was, try to do it on top of something that is technically not a vessel, not a kli. It's not mekabel tuma. This actually is something that is very doable nowadays, because a lift, basically, and these are like these portable lifts. It's like, you know, you hook it up. You basically like hook something like a chair to the lift, and then it just lowers the chair down into, you know, into the mikveh, and then it can obviously, you know, pulls the person back up. So if you make the chair plastic. Plastic is a type of a material that is not halachically considered a kli, a vessel. So there's no problem of doing it on top of a vessel because the chair is plastic. there is a problem, there is something about the concern that if the person's body weight, it's not just like holding onto an arm where you could say it's not, you could do it in a way that's not super tight. If a person's body weight is like fully down against the chair, is it really possible that water is going to get between the person and the chair? So you can solve it. You can either make a chair that's like very porous, you know, that's sort of like all like holes or type of a netting, or the person can like, you know, like lift themselves up a little bit if they're able to, you know, if they have the, you know, the upper body strength, you know, lift themselves up so that the water, you know, gets under them. But those are the halachic ways of dealing with it, and it really is, you know, people have written tshuvot about modern-day tshuvot, exactly about this topic, of how to do this lift in a way that solves the halachic issues, and that ensures that we're not going to have a terrified woman, you know, with people holding onto her arms in a way that, you know, is obviously much less appropriate for a person's dignity or sense of security and feeling like properly treated and so on. So this was just so this, you know, is an example of where the poskim really are sort of figuring out, navigating the halachic issues to make it work, but obviously informed by the sense of course we have to find a way. How could a woman not go to the mikvah? I mean, just even if you're not from like a humane perspective, just from a halachic perspective, what, we're going to let her sleep with her husband without going to the mikvah, or never sleep with her husband? So of course we've got to find a solution. But again, I want to sort of reiterate the point I made at the beginning, which is halachic solutions can be found. You know, they were found here, and you have to know what the halacha is and figure out how to accommodate it. But the real issue at the core is, you know, the community responsibility, the attitude. Is there a will? Is there a sense of an understanding of what exclusion really means and how it's experienced? You know, and really that sense of not like, is it worth it to include, but how could we think that we're going to act in any way that will be excluding people? And what do we have to do to create both physically and culturally a sense of a place in which really everybody is included? Everybody feels the membership that they, you know, that they are the member, that they're treated as the member of the community who they really are.